From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are VOA Senior Diplomatic Correspondent Cindy Sain and Washington Correspondent for Project 10 TV Australia, Michael Williams. Welcome, Cindy and Michael.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Well, here are the issues. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris made a three-nation tour of Africa this week, visiting Ghana, Tanzania, and Zambia as part of a diplomatic push by the Biden administration to deepen ties with the continent amid competition from China and Russia. President Biden told Israel that the country, quote, cannot continue, unquote, pushing ahead with deeply controversial judicial reforms. Biden's comments led Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to say he does not make decisions based on pressure from abroad. The U.S. State Department hosted the second Summit for Democracy, which included 120 countries, civil society groups, and technology companies. The mostly virtual summit included some countries which have been criticized recently for undemocratic policies. The role of women in democracy was also a focus of the summit. Ukraine called for an emergency meeting of the United Nations Security Council after Russia said it was planning to station nuclear weapons in Belarus. President Biden urged U.S. Congress to pass an assault weapons ban after a heavily armed shooter took the lives of three children and three staffers at a private Christian school in Nashville, Tennessee. Police killed the 28-year-old shooter, who had also once attended the school. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. Well, Vice President Kamala Harris visited three countries in Africa this week. She is the 18th and most senior U.S. official to visit the continent this year as the U.S. looks to loosen Russia's and China's alliances there. So, Michael, what were some of the highlights of her trip?
One of the highlights is the fact that she, a woman who identifies as a Black woman, who's had that high position in the United States to visit Africa, is a moment of great symbolism, a great symbolic import. So just the person herself setting foot on the continent and representing the United States, I think, was extremely important. As you alluded to, the Chinese and Russians have been making inroads for years into the African continent, both for the resources there, to build infrastructure there. When you go into Nigeria, for example, in the newest rail stations in Nigeria, you'll see statues of Chinese leaders rather than of Nigerian historical figures. They've been working the continent for some period of time. Although the U.S., I think, is somewhat late to the game, the idea of building trade relations, securing access to the types of resources and minerals that are essential to the manufacture of everyday items like laptops and cell phones, and creating a financial bridge through loans and import-export bank support for U.S. businesses to establish a foothold and grow. And of course, part of establishing that business culture is establishing the culture of democracy and freedom, which goes hand in hand with any U.S. diplomatic effort. I think the three countries have been very receptive. They still, I believe, have a lot of work to do as far as their social issues, particularly with LGBTQ rights in those nations. But as they say, every story starts at the beginning. I think this is a good beginning for the U.S., for the continent, and for Kamala Harris in reestablishing her significance on the political stage.
I would agree, Michael. And as you said, I think it was a very important symbolic visit. And we had Vice President Harris as the first Black vice president visiting Cape Coast Castle in Ghana, a seaside fort and dungeon where millions of Africans were held captive before being loaded onto ships and chains and shipped to America. And she was very emotional, visibly emotional, and choked back tears and talked about the resilience and the strength of the descendants of those slaves who ended up fighting for civil rights in the United States. And she was quite well received, with throngs of women and young people turning out to see her. And she pointed out that the median age of the African continent is 19, and that more than 50% of the continent is female. So she is really making a push for U.S. businesses, U.S. private enterprise, to invest in Africa and to see that as a business opportunity, and announce more than $1 billion in public-private initiatives.
And another aspect of this, there seems to be a certain amount of skepticism from African governments and even citizens Many are aware that the outbreak of the Russia-Ukraine war is a lot of the reason behind the renewed interest in Africa, and many African countries are not aligned with either Russia or the West regarding the wars. What would you say is the U.S. really trying to do? Is it trying to get African countries to choose sides?
Secretary of State Blinken has repeatedly said that they're not trying to get African countries to choose sides, that African countries are sovereign and are free to do business and to choose whoever they want. But in a broader sense, of course, the U.S. is seeking to get countries to choose sides in Russia's invasion of Ukraine, including African countries. And we've had a parade of U.S. officials, high-ranking officials, go to Africa. We have President Biden himself set to go to sub-Saharan Africa this year. And we've had them saying, look, you should understand, you know, as having suffered colonialism in the past, this is exactly what Russian President Putin is doing to Ukraine. It's a bigger country, you know, on paper, a military superior country, which has invaded another country. And so that is part of it. And U.S. officials also point out that millions of all over the world are suffering from the impact of it, including grain prices and everything that have been affected by the Russian invasion.
Well, in our next topic, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's goal to make changes to Israel's judicial system that would, among other things, let Israeli lawmakers override court rulings, a move that critics fear will badly damage Israeli democracy. And this has caused unrest and mass protests there, including public criticism from President Biden. So how much influence does the U.S. have with Prime Minister Netanyahu?
Well, Kim, of course, the U.S. has tremendous influence with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu as the biggest backer of Israel. And it was rare to see sort of a public spat disagreement break out between the U.S. and Israel, with the U.S. over the decades almost always backing Israel at the United Nations and when other countries were criticizing Israel's government treatment of Palestinians and other issues. But now with the coalition government in Israel seeking to weaken the power of the judiciary, U.S. officials, including President Biden, have been very concerned. They, you know, never seen this. Israel has been a beacon of democracy in the Middle East. And Biden said something along the lines of they can't continue along this path. And this prompted a rare late night string of tweets from Prime Minister Netanyahu saying that Israel is a sovereign country and will not be told what to do, even from the closest of friends. For now, under tremendous protests that we've been seeing, massive protests on the streets of Israel, Netanyahu has backed off but has not said that he will stop this planned reform to the judiciary. Some in Israel were very concerned about U.S. disapproval and saying that this is a wake-up call to Netanyahu and you better not do anything to damage the relationship with Israel's most important ally.
Yeah, I think those are all absolutely perfectly true and excellent observations there. And I'll just say from the initial question is, what is the leverage that the U.S. has over Israel to modify or influence its behavior? And given the political climate in the United States, to try to weaken or pull support from Israel, I think every official is looking not only at where they are now, and President Biden is expecting to run again for office. There's that whole 3D chess thing that's going on about how you manage what's going on now versus how it affects future voters. So that's a reality of the situation. The key, I think, for the diplomats is to try to ensure that while the leaders are posturing in public, that most of the real work gets done behind closed doors. Nobody likes it when these types of comments are made by leaders in public. It doesn't really serve to bring about solutions. Rather, it hardens positions. These two men have known each other for 40 years. They know each other inside and out. They've been friends. They've been adversaries. They've had every relationship nuance you can have on the spectrum. And I think they know each other well. But at the end of the day, I think they're both very practical politicians. Netanyahu has stepped back and is retrenching and trying to figure out how much of his plan to consolidate and maintain power in perpetuity he can actually put through without destroying his own position within his own country. He's learned a lot from the U.S. MAGA movement in appealing to his most right-leaning aspects, the part of that political atmosphere in his own country, even to having his son be sort of his political pit bull, suggesting that the prosecutors who were involved in Netanyahu's corruption trial should be tried themselves for treason and given the death penalty. he's following a blueprint for consolidating power. The U.S., of course, is trying to maintain the sense of strong democracy and a strong relationship. And again, the balancing act between the two leaders will go on. There'll be some posturing in public, but most of the strong and important work will be done behind closed doors with the diplomats who understand the importance of the relationship in the long run.
Very nice summary on both of you all sides for bringing out those really good points on this issue. And in our next topic, the U.S. State Department hosted the second summit for democracy. And Cindy, you've covered this summit. So what was the goal of the summit?
The goal, as stated by President Biden and the State Department, was to promote democracy in the world. It was the second summit, mostly remote. And you had President Biden basically saying that the good news is that the efforts to strengthen the world's democracies are working. We had the first round of this a couple of years ago. Things were looking pretty dicey with the U.S. having its own January 6th, where, you know, violent Trump supporters tried to stop the peaceful transition of power. He said that things are working. The U.S. in particular is trying to promote free use of the internet and to stop commercial spyware. And the U.S. is sort of in charge of tech regulation. But of course, critics, some even said basically it's a pointless exercise, pointing out that countries like Israel, which is having its own very public problems at the moment, were invited. Poland, Mexico, South Africa, India, and Brazil, other countries which have been criticized for some human rights troubles and some anti-democratic measures, whereas Hungary and Turkey were excluded.
I guess the optimistic part of Michael Williams is we'd love to see these types of summits where ideas are exchanged, meaningful relationships that can further democracy, strengthen democracies. These are important to have. Joe Biden is resolute in reestablishing the U.S. presence at the forefront of promoting democracy, promoting human rights issues, whereas the previous administration tended to more pull back and concentrate on more of the social issues that were the jumping off points. But then there's the cynical Michael, which says that this summit for democracy could, you know, very easily be called a summit for hypocrisy, because you have the host nation itself, which maintains close relationships with a number of authoritarian governments around the world. As you say, you have Turkey and Hungary, who are NATO partners, not invited. Among the attendees, Israel, the leader of that country, is attempting to weaken its democratic machinery. You have Prime Minister Modi, who expelled his biggest rival from parliament for a perceived insult on the campaign trail, and on and on and on. Again, these types of things are a particular, I would say, necessary type of theater, if you will. There is some good work and some good business that gets done. But at the end of the day, democracies are strengthened by what the people are willing to have. If they want a strong democracy, if they want truly democratic leaders who are more interested in results than in maintaining power, then that's what they get. I always refer to the quote that I heard a long time ago, and I'm not sure who to attribute it to right now, but people get the democracy they deserve. So I position the summit as something that is useful, but certainly not the sharp end of the spear when it comes to advancing and maintaining the importance of democracy around the world.
Right. And Kim, I just wanted to come back to a point that you made a bit earlier. I spoke with an analyst about the summit, and he pointed out that Ukraine was a very, very important sort of underlying issue the whole time, and that the U.S. is very much trying to get other democracies to come down on the side of Ukraine and Kyiv and against the Russian invasion. And this analyst pointed out that just because countries are democracies doesn't mean that they're going to agree on all foreign policy issues, and that you have some countries in Latin America and in Africa and elsewhere which are skeptical or trying to remain neutral on the question. And this is very frustrating for the Biden administration, but countries are going to act in what they perceive as their own national interest. And that's true whether they're democracies or not.
Excellent point. And along those lines, a Swedish research institute, VDEM, they did a survey, and it shows almost 3/4 of the world's population now live in autocracies against less than half a decade ago. When you have different mindsets, it's really hard to get everybody on the same page. Time now for a quick break. And when we return, Russia sends a warning to the West as it steps up military support for its war on Ukraine. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/issues. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype, VOA Senior Diplomatic Correspondent Cindy Sain and Washington Correspondent for Project 10 TV Australia, Michael Williams. Well, Russian President Vladimir Putin announced plans to station tactical nuclear weapons in neighboring Belarus, a warning to the West as it steps up military support for Ukraine. So, in looking at this latest announcement by Russia, what is NATO's reaction to this?
NATO's reaction has been, I call it sort of the diplomatic equivalent of whatever, because they've said that while they condemn the move and the act of aggression by Vladimir Putin, they also say that it doesn't create a need for any shift in their own deployment or in their own course of action in terms of the nuclear weapons that are controlled by and influenced by NATO. Most experts who have seen this move sort of analyze this as a saber-rattling exercise by Vladimir Putin. Virtually all experts, war and weapons experts, agree that positioning these weapons in Belarus only slightly raises the likelihood of their use, if it raises the likelihood at all. As you said, Putin has positioned this as a response to a Western country providing weapons to Ukraine. And I'm struck by how much of our conversation today is orbiting this whole situation in Ukraine. Look, the fact that having these weapons 1 inch closer to Western Europe, Putin is betting on the fact that this will weaken the resolve of Western countries when it comes to supporting Ukraine, because that is his only path to victory now, is weakening Western support. That's becoming more and more apparent, according again to military experts. It will be interesting to see, though, how the move might actually affect Belarus in particular. You have a president there who's really not that popular, and President Lukashenko, who's propped up by Putin as a military dictator. It'll be interesting to see whether this move causes popular resistance in Belarus rather than popular support. The sand continues to shift away under Putin's feet in terms of popular support in these outlying areas where he hopes to reestablish his influence. It could be that the opposite happens.
Yeah, I would agree with Michael, and experts that I've been speaking with have basically also said that this seems to be more scare tactics from Russian President Putin, perhaps a little bit like the boy who cried wolf when he said repeatedly, oh, you know, I'm not ruling out the use of nuclear weapons, or now threatening to station them in Belarus. And of course, NATO criticized, saying this was dangerous and irresponsible rhetoric. We don't want to be too casual about this sort of thing, but the U.S. and NATO also repeatedly said, as Michael said, that we don't see any need to change our actual posture on this. And we have a NATO foreign ministers meeting coming up. And as usual, the main topic is how can we best support Ukraine? And we're now seeing pictures coming out of Ukraine of the first NATO tanks arriving. Ukrainian forces have very quickly gotten up to speed and are using these tanks. Yeah, I think now there's sort of a collective holding of the breath to see, okay, when it starts to get a bit warmer and the mud starts to dry up, is Ukraine going to come out with its spring offensive? And what kind of impact is that going to have on maybe perhaps making Russian President Putin a bit more likely to want to negotiate?
Also, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has said that Ukraine will not engage in peace talks with Moscow until Russian forces have withdrawn from all of Ukraine's territory, including the Crimean Peninsula it illegally annexed in 2014. But yet, as you all point out, Russia continues its war efforts for more territory. So is this war really going the way Russia wants it to?
You're right. I mean, Zelensky has shown amazing resolve and tenacity in this whole conflict. So has the West, quite frankly. For now, Western resolve is so strong against this move, because we've seen in this conversation and in so many conversations, when it has to do with politics and the military and economic security, it is all intertwined now. We're seeing so clearly how one country's aggression and another country's submittal can lead to total chaos and breakdown of very fundamental systems. To that end, Russian aggression has been met with Western resolve that it shall not stand. And I think, if nothing else, that's an encouraging fact.
Very good point there. And let's get in our last topic. Here in the U.S., a school shooting at a private Christian school in Nashville, Tennessee, has President Biden urging Congress to pass an assault weapons ban after a heavily armed shooter took the lives of 3 children and 3 staffers. Biden, he's been pushing for this legislation for some time. Is there anything else he can do on this contentious issue?
Well, Kim, President Biden basically had to declare himself powerless to respond to what some would call a pandemic of gun violence in the United States. He said he's basically used up all of his executive orders, gone to the full extent, and basically pointed to Congress and said, it's up to you now. You have to act. And we had a remarkable exchange, sort of impromptu, outside in the halls of the U.S. Capitol with a Democratic lawmaker, Representative Jamal Bowman, just basically pointing to Republican lawmakers who are walking by and saying, you know, you're cowards. Why won't you do anything to save our children in this country? And then you had Republican Representative Thomas Massie stopping and engaging in debate with him. And Massie, I believe, was advocating schools should do more to bolster up security and arm teachers and all that. And then you had Bowman, who I believe was a principal at a school, saying, have you ever worked in a school? It's about the guns. And why won't you ban assault weapons and do something to protect the nation's children? So, of course, now with Republicans having the majority in the House again, the fact is that's not likely to happen.
Yeah, you know, I'm old enough to remember when we did have an assault weapons ban that was passed, and it did do some good. Didn't solve everything, but it did some good, and it has lapsed, and we feel it. And the number of times that I've been on this show and the time that I've been doing it, and we've talked about school shootings in the U.S., and it's a depressing number of instances that we've had to talk about this. And we talk about the number of bodies that are literally stacking up in front of us when talking about this issue, and yet the rhetoric seems to get more and more severe in each direction, not moving towards a solution, but moving more towards these entrenched positions. And I'll say, Kim, the most eye-opening and disheartening thing that I heard was from a congressman from Tennessee, the state where this happened, when asked how he would protect his daughter from such violence, said, well, we simply keep her at home. We homeschool her. And then went on to say, when talking about school shootings, we're not going to fix it. This is his quote. Criminals are going to be criminals. My daddy fought in the Second World War, fought in the Pacific, fought the Japanese. And he told me, buddy, if somebody wants to take you out and doesn't mind losing their life, there's not a whole heck of a lot you can do about it. That type of resignation in the face of slaughter of children, I found it disheartening. So, yes, President Biden literally has no recourse in this. It is up to Congress to act. Instead of acting, they're literally playing roles.
Well, it's time now to find out what is weighing on the minds of our panelists this week. And Cindy, what is weighing on your mind this week?
Well, Kim, following this democracy summit, it just kind of struck me to take a moment to think about how precious democracy is. And even more, I didn't realize the statistic that you said that, you know, most of the world's people actually do not live in democracies. But when you see, for example, people in Ukraine literally fighting and dying for it, Ukraine's government was democratically elected, and you have tens of thousands of women in Ukraine who join the armed forces. And that goes to show how powerful it is and how much it means. And just once again, you know, for myself and others, we really should not take it for granted.
Thank you. And Michael?
Well, I just returned from 2 weeks in Kenya, traveling from Nairobi through the Great Rift Valley and the Masai Mara and down to Mombasa on the coast of the Indian Ocean. And I was humbled by the majesty of the land and the wildlife that's there, and by the warmth and hospitality of the Kenyan people. Kenya is a nation of some 40-odd tribes. Most people speak 3 or more languages, but they're bound together by Swahili, their common language, which is actually a derivation from several African languages as well as Arabic. This language allows them to communicate and to share history and to plan a future. As I look at the tribalism that's so entrenched in American politics, I wonder what our common language will be to bring a sense of unity and purpose. You know, and you think it would be rooted in the common primal desire to protect children, but it seems that even the sound of their laughter or even their crying in terror seems not to have the ability to communicate the need for action and for solutions. I wonder which words or which sounds will be heard and will make a difference. And for now, I really have no answer for that.
Very interesting. And I thank you both for your thoughts there. And we will end the show on those notes. My thanks go to VOA Senior Diplomatic Correspondent Cindy Sain and Washington Correspondent for Project 10 TV Australia, Michael Williams. I'm Kim Lewis, and be sure to join us next weekend for more Issues in the News.